So today we have Lucas Parra. He is the Harold Shames Professor of Biomedical Engineering at the City College of New York. He's got an impressive resume with hundreds of papers and tens of thousands of citations. But here's what I actually appreciate about Lucas's work. Here's his most cited paper: convolutive blind separation of non-stationary sources. I don't actually really know what that means, but I know that it's complicated, and I know that it's probably a really good analysis technique. His scholar profile is littered with titles like this, involving complex things like joint decorrelation, intersubject correlation, correlated components analysis, canonical components analysis. Sometimes people end up missing the forest for the trees. Well, Lucas is in the weeds here. Yet he doesn't miss the forest, and this is evident from some of his later talk or from some of his later papers. Conscious processing of narrative stimuli synchronizes heart rate between individuals. And also from the title of his talk today, Narratives Synchronize the Body and Mind. So I will stop sharing here and turn it over to Lucas, who will tell us about narrative synchronized body and mind.
Very good. Thank you for the introduction. Thanks for organizing this event. It's a lovely group of people from all over the world, 68 participants. I was wondering how the hell do you invite all of these people to come to an online event? Welcome, everybody. Okay, so I want to do something a little different. Hopefully, it's an experiment. I like to interact with you guys. So I'm going to stop a lot and give you opportunity to ask questions. I want you to interrupt me. I'll show a little bit of code. So hopefully this is not going to be the usual endless sequence of slides that put everybody to sleep and sent them running for their email and messages. So I'll try to keep you engaged, which in fact is the topic of the presentation. I love to see people's faces. So if you're not shy about turning on your video, that'd be great. That's the way I find out that you're with me. So don't be shy, turn on the video. I'll be looking at you. There you go. I got some takers, very nice. So let's get started while you all turn the faces and look at each other and say hello. When you have questions, raise your hand. Somebody will be monitoring. And when you raised your hand, it means that you want to ask a question, and then you can unmute yourself and I'll hear your question. Otherwise, I won't know that you have a question. If you're feeling very shy, you can also type your question into the chat. And then I think Aaron will read it. That's how we're going to do it. So don't be shy about asking questions. So let me share the screen. I have to set up my screen a little bit. This can stay here. Let's see, this is going to move over there. And this is going to be wrong place. All right. So, no, that's the wrong presentation. I'm sorry about that. Pieces were not starting well. If I'm sharing the screen, yeah, I'm sharing the screen, right? Okay. You guys see the title that says Narrative Synchronizes Body and Mind, I hope. If not, somebody will tell me. So I'm at the City College of New York, beautiful campus here. The work that I'll be talking about today is from a few students, Jens Madsen, Samantha Cohen, and Jason Key, that have put this together a couple of years. There's a few more people I'll mention along the way. So I was very inspired. I don't know if you know the work from Yuri Hassan and David Heeger back in 2004. I heard a talk of theirs. It was fascinating. They had people watch movies and they were recording brain activity. This was actually with fMRI. And the basic observation is that people's brains synchronize. So they, in this case, fMRI signal as a sort of function on time ended up correlating between two individuals. I was fascinated by that work. And since I do EEG, we tried to reproduce something like that with electroencephalography. So we measure something that's called inter-subject correlation. So we have multiple people, say, watch a movie or listen to a story, and then we record in all of them the brain activity, and then we compare the brains of two subjects and correlate it with one another. And that way we measure how correlated that that is. So this is work from Jacek Dymochowski back in 2012. And the first observation is that this metric of inter-subject correlation is very strongly modulated by attention. So this was activity recorded while watching a Hitchcock clip. I don't have time to actually show you too many movies today. And the basic observation was, so each dot here, this cross, is a person watching this Hitchcock clip, about 5 minutes worth of movie. And we measure how similar is that person's brain activity to that of the group, the other participants, while they are regularly attending or when they're distracted. Our usual manipulation for distraction is count in your head in steps of seven backwards. So that's a very difficult task. Meanwhile, you're still looking at the video, you're still listening to the sound, but evidently your brain is not with it anymore because the brain activity is then no longer correlated to the subject. So we get this precipitous drop in inter-subject correlation. So this person here was very correlated to the group, and when distracted was very, I guess, uncorrelated from the group. And the effect is so strong that we can draw a line and perfectly discriminate the person attending or not attending. So I don't know about you guys, but I've worked on electroencephalography for many, many years, and I have never seen an effect this strong on any metric. So this is much stronger than alpha activity, much stronger than anything I've ever seen before in terms of measuring attention. In fact, this metric of intersubject correlation, Samantha Cohen did an experiment where she asked people about the content of the movie they just saw 3 weeks later. So 3 weeks later, people got online a quiz basically about the content of the movie they saw. And we looked at the brain activity during the video and what they recalled afterwards. So the percent correct answer, zero is the mean of the group, by the way. So people that were more correlated to the group than the average also remembered the story from 3 weeks ago better. So essentially, during encoding, we can measure how well people will, 3 weeks later, recall the content of a story. And it's a pretty robust effect. We have replicated it a couple of times. So how do we do this? How do we measure, actually, inter-subject correlation? So we measure this with components. So if you guys work with electroencephalography or MEG, perhaps the concept of a component is not new to you. So for instance, independent components, something that people are very familiar with. So we take the activity, say, from subject one, which is, you know, samples in time. This is only a cartoon brain EEG activity. It doesn't look like this, but you have multiple sensors and multiple samples. And then we combine the sensors with a weighting matrix. So say sensor one gets one value, sensor two gets another one, and so on, so that we get a single combined time course from subject one. And we do the same weighting for subject two. So we get another time course from subject two. And the objective is for these weights to be such that the red curve and the blue curve are as similar as possible. By similar, we mean correlated. So we will find weights, components, W, that will make the activity between two subjects as similar as possible. I hope this makes sense. I'm going to pause to give people opportunity to ask questions. So if there's already a question, let me now raise your hand. Really? 68 people, nobody has any questions so far.
We're 72 now. And if you're shy, please type in the chat.
All right, while you think about whether you have questions or not, let me switch to some code.
We have a raised hand.
Oh, say again?
We have a raised hand, Camila. Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
So when you say that you adjust the weights to get subject one and subject two to be as similar as possible, do you do that pairwise for the whole group, or how do you find weights that adjust the similarity for a larger group than two people?
Wonderful question. So you can do it. There's two ways of doing it. Everybody gets their own weight. So I have to adjust my brain activity to be as similar as possible. So others also, each one with their own weights, or you can share the weight. So the same weight for everybody. It turns out, and this is perhaps no surprise, that if you use the same weight for everybody, you get much smoother responses, much less noisy results, but somewhat weaker correlation. If everybody gets their own weights, then you need a lot more data to get similarly smooth results. But yes, you can do both. It's different algorithms at the end. One is called canonical correlation. The other is correlated components, which is the one that I will talk about. But a wonderful question. So it turns out doing this business with a single weight gives a little equation like this, which if you have learned eigenvalues in linear algebra at some point, you might have seen an equation like that. This is an eigenvalue equation, it's called. And principal component does the same thing. There's versions of this for independent components. So this sort of equation with eigenvalues shows up a lot. In this case, we're trying to maximize the between subject covariance divided by the within subject covariance. So if you do that and you look at the weights, you get components sort of like this. So this is the component in the EEG that during video watching captured most of the correlated activity between subjects. So this is the case where we're sharing the weights. There's a second component that looks like this and a third component that looks like that. And frankly, a fourth one that I'm not showing that's just like the third, but symmetric. So it turned out to the other way around. And let me show you some code in case you feel compelled to do this at home. So if you downloaded this, you might have gone to this website. You can do this right now. So if you go to paralab.org and click on resources, so you can, I'll give you some time, where it says intersubject correlation here on the resources, you click code and test data and you come to this page. And you can download this zip file. So I'll give you a second to do that. You can download that. So if you're a MATLAB user and if you have MATLAB on your computer, I already downloaded this. So if you don't have time to do that right now, that's quite all right. I'm going to change to, it's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to change to, let me try this.
While you're doing that, I'm going to ask a question that was on the chat.
Yeah.
It was, why don't you just calculate the coherence between corresponding channels? So I guess maybe like, what's the difference between intersubject correlation and coherence?
That's a very good question. While I fiddle with this, I will try to answer it. So why don't I just measure the coherence between individual channels? The reason for that is I can correlate one channel with the corresponding channel of the other person, or I could correlate the channel of one person with a different channel of another person. So right there, it gets combinatorial, right? All the possible correlations you could measure, coherence you could measure. I'm having a hard time, so I'm going to exit out of this and switch into MATLAB. Do you guys still see my screen? Is MATLAB on the screen?
Yes.
Yep.
Wonderful. So I hope I answered that question. So if I don't do the composition of components, I have to basically commit which electrode with which electrode to compare. And just comparing the corresponding electrodes might not really capture everything that's in it. Instead, we're going to try to capture components that is sort of virtual sensors. Think of it as a combination of electrodes that are virtual sensor. So here I'll give you some examples. So I loaded already this data file. If we look what's in memory for this data file, it's got one big variable called X, which is number of samples. In this case, typical for EEG is 50,000 samples. Let's see what's the sampling rate here. Is 256. So this is maybe a few minutes of video, maybe 5 minutes or so. I have 70 channels. So this is 64 channels plus some EOG electrodes on the eyes. And then I have 18 subjects. So they are nicely time aligned. I arranged them so that this first sample in subject one is the same moment in the video as in subject two, three, and four. So they're nicely time aligned across subject. And all this thing takes is basically a volume. If you know that some channels in these subjects are bad, you can tell it a list of channels that are not that good. And you can tell it the list of channels that are for the eye movements. And that's it. So I ran this code already. You can just type in, if you're doing this at home, you can just type ICEG, and it will use this data from Samantha Cohen from 2016. And will generate this figure that you see over here. So what are we seeing? So up above, you see the components, and this is what in ImageEEG sometimes called the forward model. So how does that activity that's shared by subject look on the surface? So this is the first one you see as occipital activity. It's not surprising. Why? Because these are participants watching movies. So it's obvious that you might find some occipital cortex involvement in here. You get this symmetric distribution, which we think is mostly auditory, and then other stuff, okay? What you see down in this panel is the level of correlation of each subject and each component. So the first component, by definition, just like in PCA, captures most of the variance. This component and this algorithm, which is called correlated component, captures most of the covariance between subjects. So it's component one and two. And each dot is a person. So how similar was that person to the group, essentially? And over here, we have the same thing resolved in time for each one of these three components. So there are moments in time, like over here, where the correlation was pretty high, that we interpret to mean that people were pretty similarly responding. And I will tell you later that, or our interpretation is that people were very attentive. So the code, if you just want to know what it spits out, it spits exactly these things that I've mentioned. It measures the overall level of intersubject correlation. It gives you a number per subject. It gives you a number per second. And then it gives you what we call a backward and a forward model. So this W is what gives you the component, and A is the corresponding forward model that's displayed here so that you have an idea of what this activity is. So this was a lot of information. I will pause again to see if people have questions. No questions?
I've got one.
They got one.
It might be a little out of it. Anyway, is there any way to yoke this to the stimulus? Like the way that one of the things that I like about it is that it's not yoked to the stimulus, and that you don't have to like input like an explicit thing. And you like, if you want to see something that's like common between two different like experiments, maybe that should be one thing, you can do that and without any like explicit stimulus thing, but sometimes it would be nice.
It's implicitly yoked to the stimulus, as in it's aligned to the stimulus. So without aligning this to the stimulus, this correlated activity would have nothing to do with the stimulus.
Right.
Both subjects or all subjects being aligned to the stimulus, we're only extracting activity that's evoked by the stimulus. So this is stimulus evoked activity and only stimulus evoked activity, because otherwise there wouldn't have anything in common. So in that sense, it's yoked. It's not yoked in the sense that we're extracting components that have something to do with specific features of the stimulus. This could be anything about the stimulus. In fact, it could be any nonlinear property of the stimulus. This doesn't have to, unlike the temporal response function approach, that's a linear relationship between a stimulus feature and the brain activity. This could be any nonlinear property of the stimulus that we're capturing, which is kind of a nice thing. It is disappointing in the sense that we don't know what these components are. And this is most of the critique that I've received for this kind of work is, well, what is this component? Well, like, what does it mean? Does it have to do with what? And so that's this thing that's perhaps a little unsettling about it. So therefore, I'll show you a different way of doing it. So the other way of doing it, which we conjecture is, so we argue that the stimulus, and I'll show you a video game just soon enough, The stimulus drives the brain in both individuals, say, and therefore it's correlated. What about measuring just simply how correlated the brain activity is with the stimulus itself? And so this approach we call stimulus response correlation or tracking. This is what people in speech would call speech tracking if the stimulus was speech. So we have our own particular way of doing this. And I'll show you this, we have done with video for the first time. So I'll show you a video. So this is, participants are playing this video game. This is like Mario Kart. And you see all these arrows, these red arrows, they're not really seeing these red arrows. This is something we extract from the stimulus. So people that do speech processing, they extract maybe the sound envelope. We for video extract the optic flow. These arrows are the optic flow, like how are things locally moving on the screen. You also see eye tracking, by the way. Those two circles in the middle is eye tracking. So we will then correlate the brain activity to how strong these red arrows are. So kind of like the volume, if you will, of the visuals. How much movement is there? And what we find is that when people are playing this game, so this is the stimulus response correlation now. So this is yoked to the stimulus, if you will, specifically optic flow. So if you look at people actively playing this game, you get pretty high correlation. So these are not small numbers, by the way, with the EEG activity and this optic flow. Now, this is the total optic flow anywhere on the screen. And then this is when they're passively viewing. Now, we also did another thing, which is we told them that they're controlling the video game with their brain activity. Of course, that was not true. They were just told that that's what they're doing. So this is brain-computer interface. They thought, oh my, this works really well. It actually, we're playing back a previous game, and they had no idea that they're not actually controlling the screen. So we call this sham play. And sure enough, people that thought they're controlling the brain, the video game, had brain activity that was just as correlated, if not more, to the optic flow in the screen as the people that were actively playing. My point being that this metric of correlation really captures how engaged the audience is with the game, even though they're not really controlling the input. So just like with the temporal response approach that you guys are familiar, we extract components. So rather than doing this one electrode at a time, we do it again with components. So this is the first, second, and third component. And these are the corresponding filters. So how does this whole thing work, actually? And here's a cartoon. And this cartoon is already too complicated. So I'm actually going to stop screen share and give people the opportunity to ask. And instead, I'm going to show you something on the board to explain what we just did. You guys see the board?
We're yep. Still here?
Any questions so far, by the way? No? All right. So the approach that maybe some of you are familiar with is that there's some stimulus feature that's coming in. Let's call it X of T. So this could be, if you've been working with sound, this might be the spectrogram over time, or it might be the speech volume over time or something like that. And that goes into a convolution. We call this a linear system, right? This is the so-called temporal response function. More conventionally, by the way, this is called the impulse response. So I resent Ed Lalo for calling it what it should be. But at any rate, temporal response function signed by me. It's the impulse response. And then the output is some other thing, namely the brain activity. Okay. And so this is essentially the model of the temporal response function. And people call this model, so Y of T is H convolved with X of T. They call this encoding. This is an encoding model. How does the brain signal encode the feature of the stimulus? So that's that some of you are familiar with. Another approach is very popular in also in EEG, but also in fMRI, is to decode the brain activity. So a lot of what the news articles pick up about brain reading works kind of like what I'm just about to draw, which is you have many brain signals, maybe like so. And so you have, at every moment in time, you have a whole vector. Let's call this Y vector, Y of T. Okay? And that vector Y of T gets multiplied with a matrix. And out comes the stimulus feature, X of T. So the equation here is something like X is W times Y. Okay, and of course, these things can also depend on time. This could also be multiple features, and this can also depend on time. And so this is typically called decoding, brain decoding. So this is a brain reading, right? So all of the news articles you see about, oh my God, we can decode speech or music or whatever else from brain activity are some flavor of this. Decoding. So what we did is what you just saw that we did with that video game and other applications is sort of a hybrid thing. It's a bit of both. So we take the stimulus and pass it through an encoder with a convolution like so. So this is, again, X of T. That generates a signal C of T. And on the other end, we're going to decode. So we have the brain activity measured here, that's Y of T. Makes another signal, C of T. And the goal is that they're as correlated as possible. So this measures correlation. We call this stimulus response correlation. Okay, so that's the approach. And this is sort of a hybrid between encoding and decoding. All right, so that's the approach that we have taken with the results that you just saw on video games. We've done this also with speech and a whole bunch of other things. So let me go back to screen share. So I'll show you some more results. Any questions so far?
Yeah, there was one in the chat and then another that might want to ask you in person.
Yeah,
in the chat, can one move from sensor space to source space with the metric just presented to quantify interpersonal correlation?
So to go back to this picture. So this picture here, this would be the source, right? And this would be the sensor. And yes, you can go back and forth between the two. So the going backwards is what's called the forward model. So this is a forward model and this is the backward model. So what the algorithm really extracts is the backward model, but you can always reconstruct a forward model from it. And in fact, what I was showing you before was the forward model. So going from source space to sensor space, but you can also go that way. In fact, that's what the algorithm really does. By the way, the algorithm to find these things is called canonical correlation analysis, was developed by Hotling in the 50s. So it's a really old algorithm. It's not something we invented. What we invented is this sort of idea of doing both decoding and encoding at the same time. All right, other questions?
Yeah, I had a quick question about the type of stimuli that you can use.
Yeah.
So I'm more familiar with auditory evoked responses, thinking of like ba and da or something repeated over and over. Yeah. Can you do this kind of analysis on that using that type of stimuli, or does it need to be continuous stimuli?
No, anything works. Now, if you have events like the ones you have, the conventional approach is event-related potentials. It turns out that doing something like this, or even the temporal response function without, by the way, this thing here, what I drew here, if you get rid of this, you're basically back here. And this is what, if you get rid of this sort of complication of extracting components, but you do it electrode at a time, one electrode at a time, you get the conventional temporal response function. So does the temporal response function or this one work for events like the ones you have? And the answer is yes. And the impulse response you find here, the temporal response function, you will call an evoked response or an event-related potential. So absolutely, you can do with either.
Okay. And then
other questions?
My other question that I had is, you're just displaying three components. Is that just because of those are the three largest, or is it like ICA where, you know, if you have 128 channels, you get 128 components?
You get 128 components here too, but they're nicely sorted by relevance. The first one captures most of the correlation. The last one captures the least. Okay. And mostly you're in the noise at the end. So unlike ICA that doesn't have a preference for one component or another, this decomposition technique gives you a sorting for the one that explains most of the stimulus, and then the second and the third and so on. And between each other, they are actually uncorrelated. So you can think of this as doing temporal response function and some sort of blind decomposition at the same time.
Are they
silly ICA in front because you're doing it here?
Sorry, I had a question, but I just totally forgot it when you were saying that last part. I'll ask it again if I think of it.
Okay. We're good? I'm happy to chat and not show any more slides. Ed Lawler in the house. Very nice. Hi, Ed.
I have a question, Lucas.
Yeah.
Do you think, in terms of number of subjects, would there be an upper bound to what you can get? Like, is it the case that if you keep adding subjects, it will keep getting better?
Or which of the two techniques, the inter-subject correlation, you know?
I suppose, sorry, I'm talking about the CCA style, the inter-subject the correlation. Yeah.
So, you know, the more subjects you have, the more robust it becomes in a way. But also it gets blurrier. So you might argue that eventually too many is too many. Usually we get nice results with this starting at 15 and upwards. You can, by the way, Alain de Gévenier, he has done it with extracting components for each individual subject. He's done similar things. So you can mix and match whatever you want, either single set of components for all subjects or each one gets their own. It's a usual sort of parameter, number of parameters issue.
Would you ever mix different types of recordings?
What do you mean by different types?
Even, you know, starting from simple to, you know, data recorded from here in my lab and recorded in your lab, still EEG, but, or even EEG, MEG.
If they are in the same sensor space, so if they have the same location of electrode, I think that's quite all right. If you are combining activity from different sensors altogether, I would have to think a bit about it, but I think you could potentially play games and combine. But I have to think about it. Certainly not off-the-shelf code. So let me show you some code for this. So this is stimulus response correlation. It's the same website under resources. You click here. It brings you to Jacek's GitHub. You download the code here, download. I did this already. So let me change to MATLAB to show you what that looks like.
Are you doing that? I remembered my question. Are all the components that come out, are they all nonlinear, or do you have like all the linear parts of the relationship in the first component, like CCA, I think it is?
So no, this is now back to the linear world. So here you're extracting linear relationship between the stimulus feature and the brain activity. So this is very much like the temporal response function. You're limited to linear response. There's nothing nonlinear here. So let me demo the code that I hope I answered it. This is the code that I have from Jacek. That says demo. Let's see. Let's run this thing. Demo. That's not the demo. It gave me some sort of MATLAB demo. That's not the one I want to run. I have to change here now again. So these are the correlations in the first component. So these are the three components that they extracted and they corresponding impulse responses. This is on data of a single subject. So these are a little noisy. If we had run this on more, say 10 or 15, it would have come out a lot smoother. But what you see here, the first one at least resembles the figures in the paper, which is this figure here, where we see that the activity, so this was, again, this was the sham play versus passive viewing. We see that the activity around 400 milliseconds was weaker in the passive viewing, and that was predominantly in the electrodes in the back of the head, as indicated by this first component. Can we do this with other stimuli? So we have done it with a lot with video. We have done it also with the usual things like speech envelope and even the semantic dissimilarity signal and a whole bunch of things. So you can use this pretty much where you would usually use it in speech. One example that I thought was kind of cool, we did this with the optic flow in different locations of the screen. So we looked at how much correlation, so stimulus response correlation, so how correlated is optic flow between a location and the screen and the brain. And so this gives us essentially a map in this video game where our subjects responding to, I would argue, attending to. And interestingly enough, during active play, they're paying attention to the horizon, the upcoming buildings, presumably because they're making an attempt not to crash into them. And we don't see that as clearly in the passive viewing. By the way, the eyes are always peeled to the center of the screen, so that's not related to eye movements. So let me just summarize what I've told you so far. It's a sort of a partial summary of this talk. Natural stimuli drive the brain, but only when the mind is engaged. So basically, when you're not attending, we had seen that with intersubject correlation, the intersubject correlation drops precipitously. Or in this video game, we saw that when the brain is no longer correlated to the stimulus, then we know that people aren't paying attention and aren't really engaged. And these are basically two metrics that we have used to measure this. So this sort of concludes that part. The main title of my talk, though, is not just about the brain, but about the body. So I'm going to switch topic on us, unless there are questions so far. So now we're going to start working with not just the brain signals, but we started looking at the heart, specifically the heart rate. We capture now respiration. We are going to measure gaze position, the pupil size in addition to the EEG. And we do this with audio only or with audiovisual stimuli. So videos or continuous speech, audiobooks, that kind of thing. So this is work that Jens Madsen has been doing over the last several years, I would say. And we had some really interesting results. So here I'm going to show you some basic signals. This was collected while people were watching educational videos. You'll get to see one of them in a minute. So this is EEG. The two colors are two participants. This is the heart rate. So you see how the heart rate is going up and down here. This is over several seconds. So this little bar here is 1 second. Gaze position, you see these two subjects are pretty much, I don't know if this vertical or horizontal gaze position, pretty much looking at the same place on the screen while watching movie. This the pupil size. The pupil size in these two people is also very correlated. And this is respiration. So as we inhale, it goes up. And when we exhale, it goes down. You see that they seem to go up and down, but it actually they're not very correlated. So we published this in PNAS Nexus. I'll show you the gates. And here I have an audience participation. So I need you to all pay attention. So you're going to see the same video. And on the left, you will see the red dots that you see here are the gaze position of people watching a video. And on the right, the same thing, but it's different people. And one of the group of people, either left or right, were paying attention. And on the other side, people that weren't paying attention. And the task for you will be to tell us or guess after you watch this, who is paying attention? Is it the people on the left? So these red dots on the left, or is it the people on the right? So I'm going to show you the video and then we're going to take a poll, okay? An informal poll. Ready? So which one of the two groups are paying attention?
When you ask someone to draw a star, they'll probably draw something like this, or this, or this. Even ignoring rainbows, this doesn't seem very scientific, since we know stars are actually big, hot, round balls of plasma and far.
All right, so now comes my poll. Raise your hand if you think that the people on the left, these people, were paying more attention. So everybody that thinks it's the people on the left, please raise your hand. We'll take an informal count. Okay, we got about 32 people raised their hand. Okay, everybody raised a hand down. Hand down, hand down. Now we're going to see who thinks the people on the right were paying more attention.
No one.
Oh, wow, that's a biased sample. That's a totally biased sample. All right, well, good. You guys were right. I mean, the majority has the right answer. It's the people on the left that were more attentive. Essentially, when people move their eyes together, are following the same thing on the screen, it's because they're paying attention. If they're not following what other people are looking at, then they're probably spaced out. And this is here, this is what we report here for all the signals for EEG, heart rate, gaze position, and pupil. We're measuring intersubject correlation, but now we actually also resolved it by frequency. So this is essentially a coherence measure. So we wanted to know in which frequency is this happening. Before I was just showing you overall how correlated are people. Here you see that the EEG correlation is actually dominant at pretty low frequencies. Most of you or most of us, when we analyze EEG, we look at activity of 1 second or faster. Most of the activity that seems to be synchronizing, yes, there's something above 1 hertz, even around 10 hertz, but most of it is pretty slow. Here's for heart rate. And by the way, how do we measure heart rate intersubject correlation? Simply as Pearson correlation, nothing fancy. Except here we first bandpass filter the signals. So you see that there's a nice peak here around sort of 10 seconds, 0.1 hertz is 10 second time scale where the heart rate goes up and down. So basically when we're watching a movie, and this is also true when we're listening to a story, our hearts synchronize. So this is kind of a cute message here. When you're driving in your car next time and you're listening to a radio program that's playing live, then your heart rate, if you're really paying attention to the story, will be synchronized with that of all other listeners. So we do share something in common when we really go to the movies or we listen to a story at the same time. Our hearts are in sync. The same is for the gaze position, is a very strong effect with video. And the same is true for pupil. So when we look at this metric of intersubject correlation, it turns out it's very predictive of whether people get content of the stories they saw correct. So these are educational videos. We asked afterwards quiz questions about the content of the video. And you see that pretty much all metrics except respiration are predictive of how many questions people got correct. So these are questions that were asked right after the video. So whether it's heart rate or EEG or gaze or pupil, they all predict the level of synchrony in how similar you are to a group will tell me if you're paying attention, therefore, if you remember what was said during the video. Again, if there are any questions, feel free to interrupt me.
It's okay. You've got people here answering questions for you now.
Okay. And in fact, these metrics seem to be correlated with one another. So subjects, each dot is here a person. People that have an I-intersubject correlation, the ISC in the EEG will also have a high intersubject correlation, the heart rate. That is, if your heart is beating similarly to somebody else, then so is your brain. And similarly for gaze and pupil. So this seems to all capture a common underlying phenomena. And so the theory we have behind it is that it's really the cognitive processing of the stimulus is what entrains body and mind. So essentially, say the video that in this similar thing happens with audio only, subject one maybe is attending to the video in subject two, and that will synchronize eyes, heart, and maybe other signals. And the level of synchrony in one modality will be similar to the level of synchrony in the other because body and mind are really all entrained to the stimulus, but only again if they pay attention. If they're not paying attention, none of this is true. And this is how these signals are co-modulated. Now, you see that I've drawn these arrows in two directions. Generally, we think that the brain controls the eye and maybe the brain controls the heart, but there's also this notion that the body controls the brain to some regard. So perhaps it's a two-way street. And so we're not the first to suggest that. The model that we have really is a sort of a simplified model. We know that when we're listening to a story, somehow that seems to drive also not just the brain, sort of the cortical brain that we pick up with EEG, but when we listen to a story, it appears to drive the autonomic system, which then drives the pupil, the gaze, and the heart rate. But perhaps the opposite is also true. Perhaps the heart rate or the gaze or the pupil also drive the autonomic system, and this is sort of has a bottom-up effect. Does that make sense? So here we ran a couple of experiments where we intentionally controlled luminance, gaze, and breathing. I won't be able to tell you all of this. We just don't have the time for it today. But I'll tell you a little bit of the results, and it's already complicated enough. So here are some results of people just listening to a story. So this is short stories, maybe 10 minutes or 5 to 10 minutes long. They're kind of fun and interesting to listen to. And what we first see is that the pupil synchronizes, but again, only if people are paying attention, and the synchronization is pretty stark. So attentive, again, at this very slow rate, the pupil of individuals synchronizes, but not when they're distracted. This is a very strong effect. We had seen this with video, but with video, there's always the concern that maybe it's just the fluctuations of light that cause the pupil to dilate and contract. The same happens apparently when we're just listening to the story. By the way, people are watching, looking at a blank screen. We asked them to focus on a screen and there's a fixation cross, but regardless of the fixation cross, whether it's there or not, the pupil entrains apparently to the story. So there are moments in the story where everybody's pupils dilated and moments in the story when people's pupils are constricted, but only if they're really attending to the story. We correlated the pupil with the EEG. So this is conventional temporal response functions. So zero is zero delay. This side means that the EEG is ahead of the pupil, and this side means the pupil is ahead of the EEG. So it's not clear which way the causal relationship goes. It seems to be that a portion of the EEG seems to respond, the pupil seems to fluctuate before the EEG does and vice versa. So we don't have a clear causal story. But the important thing I want you to notice is that if we look at where this activity is coming from, it seems to come from this sort of anterior central portion of the brain, which I've seen in many studies that look at the anterior cingulate. So we haven't done source reconstruction here, but we highly suspect that that's what might be going on. So that's the pupil while people listen to narratives. How about the heart? So the heart, we look at the heart rate, not the every beat, but the heart rate. And we did, again, this temporal response function business. So we take the pupil size and try to predict the heart rate from it. And we see that there is a significant response just a little bit on the temporal side that corresponds to the heart being ahead of the pupil. Similarly, if we try to predict the pupil from the heart, we get a more clear story here, which again is the side where the heart is ahead of the pupil. So it seems to be that the fluctuations of heart rate are ahead of the pupil's fluctuations. And we do the same thing with the EEG signal. So can the heart rate predict the EEG signal? And by and large, we see positive time lags here, which means that the heart is ahead of the EEG. Now, this is quite surprising. This is telling us that the heartbeat is slowing down or speeding up almost half a second to a second ahead of a corresponding, what we would call evoked potential or potential fluctuation. And once again, same culprit, same location on the scalp. And this, by the way, is true whether a person's attending, distracted, or resting. So inherently, it seems that the heart rate fluctuations precede fluctuations of the EEG of this sort of slow time scale. And this is, once again, activity that to us looks a lot like anterior cingulate. So the story that emerges here that perhaps the heart, and by the way, we can also drive it with breathing that confirms this observation that I'm drawing here. So breathing is known to drive the heart rate up and down, seems to be driving the autonomic system, which then affects the pupil size and also the electroencephalography. So there seems to be evidence here for a bottom up effect of autonomic function of the heart onto a pupil and brain. So one last thing that I found cool that we found out is about gaze. So it turns out that when we are listening to a story attentive, our eyes are moving around more. So gaze, the power of gaze position is basically how much are our eyes bouncing around on the screen. So when we're attentive, we're actually moving our eyes more than when we're distracted. I don't know if you noticed it, but somebody that's not listening to you, they tend to sort of stare blankly at you. They're not really following anything. So the attentive listener will actually move their eyes. The disattentive, distracted listener would sort of stare blankly in the middle. And it turns out that this amount of fluctuations of eye movements also correlates between subjects. So the amount of how much you're bouncing your eyes around changes in a story. So moments of the story, well, I don't know which ones, but some moments of the story, people move their eyes more than other moments of the story. And if we look at that gaze variation signal too seems to correlate with this sort of anterior activity, though here it's possible that this has to do with the frontal eye field. So at any rate, this I thought is a kind of an interesting observation that I don't think is in the literature in any kind of way. We move our eyes depending on whether we're attending or not to what we're listening. So to summarize it all, narratives drive the brain and the body at a very slow time scale, but only when the mind is really engaged. Otherwise, the body does not seem to entrain at all. This sort of brain-body connection may be a two-way street, and we can measure these things either with intersubject correlation or with stimulus response correlation. We like to do one result in time because it gives us these sort of causal interpretations, and we like to resolve the other in frequency because it gives us an idea of what time scale this is operating at. And with this, I would like to thank the people. Jacques Cossette is the guy in Paris, by the way, who works on patients with disorders of consciousness, who brought us to pay attention to this heart signal. And these are the students that have been involved in all this work. Code is here. You can just go to resources and download it on this page. And with that, I'm going to stop and give people opportunity to ask questions.
Well, thanks, Lucas. It's really cool to see that pupil EEG work come to fruition after the COG here meeting last year. It's
yeah.
Really cool. So if you want to ask questions, now is a great time. Raise your hand and I'll unmute you. Or you can ask a question. Here's a question in the chat. If the distractor is a stimulus that is correlated with the stimulus, How would you think it may affect the results? Would that in turn increase the IFC? And is it a linear relationship with distractor strength?
So this business of how to distract people is really a subtle problem, right? The way we have done it, and this was a suggestion by Simon Kelly, by the way, who maybe some of you know, Simon Kelly's idea was do not distract people by putting stuff on the screen, because then you're not really sure, are you analyzing activity associated with the distractor, or are you analyzing activity that's this distraction related itself? So he suggested instead to do a very classic thing, which is a mental task. So you just tell people do something in your head. What's a good mental task? You can do any kind of thing. You can ask them to think about what you were doing, what you have for breakfast, or you can ask them, well, the task we use is to do math. So do complicated math in your head, count in steps of 7 backwards, starting at say 1,000. So it's 1,000 is 993, 986, and 979. So you already see I'm staring blankly into space. And so that's the approach we take. And so this is all silent. So there's no stimulus to confound your task. But yes, this whole business of distractors and measuring attention with a probe stimulus is a whole complicated story that I don't really have any good answers.
Hey, Lucas, I had a question as well. Sorry I was late for your talk. I was teaching this morning. I'm still in my classroom here, actually. I just joined as soon as I could. The question I had was the cool new findings with the eye movements and stuff like that as well. Maybe you explained this and I didn't get it at the time, but I was interested to know the kind of speed of those, the size of those. Are these what we would consider just regular saccades? Are they micro saccades? Do you need to measure them using some super fancy eye tracker, or is it coarser than that?
It's coarse. So it's literally, you know, when I'm looking around, I can be looking around in a fairly narrow sort of area, or I can be looking around a fairly big area. And that's it. We're basically measuring the power resolved in time. Mm-hmm. Think of it as the saccade envelope, mm-hmm. or not saccade, but gaze envelope. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Cool. So okay.
Variation. So there's a paper that we cite that's also looked at this. Is gaze variation is a term that maybe is going to catch on. It's not saccades. It's not smooth pursuit. We don't really care. We're completely agnostic to it. We just like over a period of time, how wide was your range that mm-hmm. you covered? Mm-hmm. That's cool. It. And cool. So that range is what seems to be in moments of the story be bigger and other moments of the story be smaller. And why? Mm-hmm. I think it's a wonderful area of research now to find out, because the thing that I find interesting about it is it's incidental movement. So it's movement is totally unrelated to the task. Just like you right now, are you touching your face, right? That's incidental movement, totally unrelated to you're listening to me. Hopefully you're listening. Looks like it. but so we do all of these incidental behaviors are seemingly totally a task unrelated, and yet they dominate brain activity. Perhaps you follow that literature, but also we find that they are linked to what we're doing in our head, right? We're listening to the story, and apparently that's driving these. We think it has to do with arousal. Different moments of the story increase arousal, and that's when we move our eyes perhaps more. That's our current hypothesis. We have to still figure it out.
Cool, thanks.
Here's one from the chat. Do you think it would be interesting or informative to measure inter-subject correlation without a shared stimulus? A lot of research is done to study interpersonal neural synchronization, where people are actually trying to exclude the synchronization due to shared sensory input.
So we record people sequentially, like, you know, now we're recording you and tomorrow we'll record another subject and so on, right? So there's no way they'll be synchronized any kind of way other than through the stimulus. Now there's a very big literature in what's called physiological synchrony, PS, in physiological signal, where the interest is sort of when people are sitting together side by side or looking at each other, interacting in some kind of way, that somehow they are then synchronized, their physiology is synchronized. Classic example, mother and child, or therapist and patient, or a performance and audience. So there's a whole sequence of a series of papers along those lines where it's never really quite well controlled. Why are they synchronized? Is it because they're sharing the moment and there's some common stimulus, or is this some sort of empathic correlation? But I would contend that if you put a screen between the two people and they don't see each other, then they don't hear each other, and they don't smell each other, there's nothing that can possibly synchronize, unless you believe in some sort of, esoteric kind of thing. And so I think that the only way that people will synchronize is because they are somehow sharing something that they're perceiving. And so I think that understanding what it is that synchronizes people in these interpersonal situations is kind of an interesting topic, and there's a big literature, but let's not pretend that this is some sort of voodoo synchronization. It really is, I believe, the sensory percept of the other person that will synchronize people, even when they are sitting together.
Hi, Lucas. Nick Cross here. I have a question.
Hey.
Great talk. I found your work really interesting, looking at all the relationships between these different biometrics. And I'm wondering, looking at this correlation you showed between the heart and EEG, or heart rate, do you think that there are any interesting or useful markers of cognitive function that could be determined from like a smartwatch heart rate measure? Given that we're seeing a lot of companies trying to develop brain computer interfaces now, and all sorts of different neurotechnologies.
Absolutely. I mean, the watch has a problem that's very noisy, but if you get a high-end armband, absolutely. I do think that you could do all kinds of in-the-wild experiments, and we want to do it, and we're thinking of how to do them. And we're doing a lot of online experiments with eye movements already. Yes, go for it. I think absolutely it's a very rich signal. I mean, I don't know if you caught the scale of these correlations that I was displaying on the screen. They're much bigger than EEG signals. So the correlation of the pupil that we find and the heart rate, I mean, it's a noisy signal, I give you that. You need something for the heart in particular, you need much longer record because, it's a very slow signal. So you need a lot longer records. But the level of correlation is definitely higher than the EEG, for instance.
Yeah, and so presumably
we're only scratching the surface. I think there's so many experiments you can think of looking at pupil, heart.
Yeah.
Now, I should say it's not the heartbeat. It's not like people's beat synchronizes. It's the heart rate. So your heart might be going boop, 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 boop. It's that speed up and slow down. That's what synchronizes. Not the actual beat to beat. It's not like our hearts are in absolute synchrony beat by beat. But that's not the case.
Thanks.
Okay, so for the sake of time, we'll move on. Thank you, Lucas. Everyone join me in thanking him with our... There. Click that button. Thanks, Lucas. That was a great talk. I really enjoyed it.